The only one that hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Coming up on the program, Dan Friedel and Jill Robbins have a story about winemaking in Spain, and Brian Lynn reports on the discovery of the closest black hole to Earth. Later, we present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first,
genetic researchers in Spain's wine country believe grapevines that have lived for more than 35 years are better able to deal with high temperatures brought by climate change. Winemakers in the Rioja area in northern Spain make some of the best wine in the world. Wine has been made there for hundreds of years. But in recent years, winemakers there have been having trouble producing good wine. They say the wine tasted better in the past, when temperatures were usually cooler. The 2022 summer was the hottest in Spain since record-keeping began in 1961. Temperatures were 2.2 degrees Celsius, higher than average. Researchers like Pablo Carbonell think older grapevines may be able to grow better in higher temperatures. As part of his research work, Carbonell looks at rows of gray shapes on his computer screen. Among them was a green rectangle. This, he said, represents a kind of grapevine that produces grapes that take longer to ripen, even in warmer conditions.
A longer ripeness period is what winemakers want. The current vines produce grapes that are ready to pick too early. Such grapes do not make wine that has the right color and smell. The wine also has too much alcohol. People who work in the vineyards have long crossed old vines with new ones. Now they are working with special laboratories, like the one where Carbonell works, to find a climate-resistant vine. The place is called the Vine and Wine Research Institute. It is known as the ICVV in Spain. The scientists there are studying the genomes of commonly used grapes in Spanish wine. The lab is working to keep the Spanish winemaking industry alive as temperatures rise. The scientists say the older grapevines have a more diverse genetic makeup. Spain is the third largest winemaking country in the world, behind France and Italy. Spanish wine production is worth close to $5 billion in the country's economy each year. The United Nations warns that climate change will cause Europe to lose crops due to heat, dry conditions, and extreme weather. The report will be included in the discussion at the COP27 International Climate Meeting, which began this week in Egypt and runs until November 18th.
The Rioja region has 500 wineries and makes up 21% of Spain's wine production, totaling over $1.5 billion each year. Spain needs the region's wine production to continue. Inigo Torres is director of Grupo Rioja, a trade association representing 60 wineries in the region. "We are very worried about climate change," he said. He noted that this year's grape harvest started 2 weeks early. The change affects the way the wine tastes. Torres said the warmer weather also limits how many grapes grow on each vine. As a result, total wine production has gone down by 5 to 10% over the last 4 years. Jose Miguel Martinez Zapater is the director of ICVV. He and his scientists are working to analyze the wine. They are looking at vine cuttings that are close to 100 years old.
He said the laboratory is doing the same kind of work scientists have done to sequence the human genome. But instead of looking for mutations that cause diseases, the wine scientists are looking for traits or qualities that might permit the vines to survive in a warmer climate. In addition to the genetic research, scientists are also working on different planting methods. A winery called Roda is planting vines in a curve instead of a straight line. The hope is that plants will soak up more water this way. The new vineyard is made up of vines that were over 100 years old and moved from another place. Maria Santolaya is an agricultural engineer and part of Roda's technical team. She said she hopes next summer is not as hot. The hot weather, she said, has been very problematic. But our biggest concern, she added, is what will happen in 20 or 30 years. We don't really know how things will come out. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Dan Friedel.
Scientists say they have discovered the closest black hole to Earth. Black holes are areas in space where gravity is so strong that nothing, not even light, can escape them. They are believed to be formed from collapsed stars. An international group of astronomers recently announced the discovery of the black hole, which sits about 1,600 light-years from Earth. A light-year is the distance light travels in 1 year. In space, light moves about 9.4 trillion kilometers each year. The researchers named the black hole Gaia BH1. They say it sits in the constellation of Ophiuchus. A constellation is a grouping of stars. The black hole is believed to weigh about 10 times the mass of our sun. The team said it is 3 times closer to Earth than the previous record holder. The newly discovered gravitational mass was identified by observing the motion of its orbiting star. The star orbits the black hole at about the same distance as Earth orbits the sun. Karim El-Badri is an astrophysicist with the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics and Germany's Max Planck Institute for Astronomy. He was the lead writer of a study describing the discovery in monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. The black hole was first identified using the European Space Agency's Gaia spacecraft. Gaia has already discovered more than 800,000 multi-star systems. El-Badri and his team then sought to confirm the discovery through numerous additional observations over a period of 4 months. This effort involved 6 different highly sensitive telescopes across the world. One was the 6.5-meter Magellan Botta Telescope based at the Las Campanas Observatory in Chile. The team also used an instrument on the Gemini North Telescope, which is based in Hawaii. The researchers needed such telescopes to effectively observe the orbital motion of the black hole's star. The telescope in Chile and the Gemini instrument were able to provide the astronomers with high-resolution images. The telescopes also collected sensitive data on ultraviolet and near-infrared wavelengths. El Badri said in a statement, "The Gemini observations confirmed beyond a reasonable doubt that the team had discovered a normal star and at least one black hole." El Badri added that the black hole appears to be dormant, meaning not currently active. When active, black holes give off high-energy light. While dormant, they give off nothing and are difficult to identify. The scientists said it remains unclear how the black hole formed in our Milky Way galaxy. Examinations of data collected on Gaia BH1 suggests its existence is difficult to explain using traditional evolutionary modeling methods, said Tinica Rohiers. She is a project information specialist with the Gaia spacecraft team. The researchers said if the black hole formed the traditional way, from the gravitational collapse of a star, that star would have been at least 20 times the mass of our sun. This means the star would have only lived a short time, maybe only a few million years. If both stars had formed at the same time, the scientists say, the massive star would have quickly turned into a supergiant and swallowed the other star before it had a chance to fully develop. These differences, Rohiers said, may indicate something important is missing from our current knowledge of black hole formation. El Badri said the mystery about Earth's closest black hole presents many questions about how it formed, as well as how many of these dormant black holes there are out there. He added, "I have been searching for a system like Gaia BH1 for the last 4 years, trying all kinds of methods, but none of them worked. It has been elating to see this search finally bear fruit." I'm Brian Lynn.
You just heard this week's Science Report with Brian Lynn. I'm pleased to welcome Brian to the podcast to speak more about his story. Hi, Brian. Thanks for joining me.
Of course, Dan. Thanks for having me.
This week's report centered on how astronomers recently announced the discovery of the closest black hole to Earth. Let's talk about one of the terms that appears in the story, evolutionary. I know that the root word evolution also shows up in a lot of other science-related stories, but what can you tell us about the meaning of this word?
So in this story, as you mentioned, evolutionary is used to mean the process by which something developed over time. And usually we're talking about changes that happened over many, many years of time. In the story about the black hole discovery, the scientists were describing methods they used to predict how black holes and other elements in space formed and developed over millions of years.
And how is the root word evolution generally used?
Well, evolution can actually describe the development over time of just about anything, but in science, we're usually talking about the development or evolutionary process of all kinds of living things, such as plants, animals, and humans.
Great. Thank you for the explanations, Brian. And thanks again for coming on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you, Dan.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about the Amistad case. The Amistad was a slave ship from Cuba. In 1839, it appeared off the eastern coast of the United States. The Africans on the ship had killed white crew members, including the captain. They demanded to go back home to Africa. But the two remaining slave traders on the ship secretly sailed the Amistad toward the United States. The U.S. government put the Africans in a low-security prison in New Haven, Connecticut, and it made plans to take the Africans to court. A judge would decide whether the occupants of the ship were slaves who had rebelled, murderers, or captives who had been kidnapped from their homes. The Amistad case brought attention once again to the issue of slavery in the United States. At the time, slavery was legal and an important part of the country's economy. But the U.S. and several European countries had banned the international slave trade. A small group of activists wanted to totally end slavery. They believed slavery was a sin. But in the 1830s, most Americans did not support these anti-slavery activists known as abolitionists.
Most Americans, first of all, were racist, and secondly, saw these people as utter fanatics who were intent on destroying the Union.
Julie Roy Jeffrey is a professor of history at Goucher College in Maryland. She says newspapers reported on the Amistad case, and people began talking about slavery and the slave trade. Slowly, some Americans' feelings toward the abolitionist movement and enslaved Africans changed.
For example, there was a play put on in New York City called The Black Schooner that was based on the Amistad incident. And there were many, many people who went to see it. It became a popular event. And wax figures of the captives were exhibited in various places in the United States, and artists drew pictures of them.
The abolitionists wanted to make more Americans sympathetic to the Amistad Africans. They found lawyers to represent them, paid tutors to teach them, and organized outdoor exercises to keep them healthy and visible. Howard Jones taught history at the University of Virginia. He says one of the most popular members of the Amistad Africans was an 8-year-old boy who had learned English. The boy told the public about his life in Africa and about the conditions on the slave ship that brought him across the Atlantic Ocean. The Amistad case also was increasingly becoming a political issue. People wanted to know what President Martin Van Buren was going to do about the case. Historian Howard Jones says Van Buren found the position difficult. He did not want to anger Southern voters who supported slavery and wanted to make the African slave trade legal again. He also did not want to anger Northern voters who believed the Amistad Africans had been mistreated.
Van Buren did what any good politician would do, and that was to try to dodge the issue, stay away from it. He couldn't understand why 40-plus, by this time, black people should affect anything happening in high political society.
But the Amistad issue would not go away. The case began in a circuit court. After 3 days, it went to a district court. The district court judge ruled that the African slave trade was illegal under international treaties. For that reason, the Africans were wrongly taken. President Van Buren was worried the decision would cause more political problems for him, so he ordered the nation's highest court, the Supreme Court, to hear the case. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court at that time was Joseph Story. Story did not like slavery, but he did not support the abolitionist movement either. He thought its ideas opposed the rule of law. The abolitionists had good lawyers, but they knew they needed more help arguing their case in the Supreme Court. So they turned to former President John Quincy Adams. At the time, Adams was a congressman, not an abolitionist. But he led a campaign against an 1836 rule restricting anti-slavery petitions. Adams said the rule was a violation of the constitutional right to petition Congress. Historian Julie Jeffrey says the 1836 gag rule, as it was called, helped the abolitionists' cause.
It became partly a freedom of speech issue, not just about slavery, but about the rights of citizens to speak out and to be heard by their representatives in Congress.
Yet John Quincy Adams was not excited about arguing the Amistad case. He was 72 years old, nearly blind, and very busy. But the issue of the Amistad Africans troubled him. Howard Jones says Adams believed capturing people and enslaving them was immoral, especially in a country like the United States. In the end, Adams agreed to defend the Africans.
And he makes the argument in the court case that we have the Declaration of Independence right there on that wall, and that says that life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, it doesn't say for white people only or anything like it. He was trying to argue that it's something that's available for everyone. It's part of the justice system.
Chief Justice Joseph Story did not totally accept Adams' argument or suggest that any kind of slavery was wrong, but he did agree with the district court that these Africans had been taken illegally from their homes. They were not and had never been slaves, Justice Story said. They were free people and should be returned home. So in 1841, the remaining 30 or so members of the Amistad captives got on a ship called the Gentleman and returned to West Africa. Howard Jones says the incident was the only time he knows that black people who had been brought to the New World as slaves actually made it back home.
And how they do it? By winning in the American court system. This was just unheard of. But the decision was basically that it doesn't matter whether you are black, white, purple, green, or whatever color you are, you have been kidnapped. And so therefore you have, and Joseph Story said this in his decision, which really opened the door for a lot of arguments, that under the eternal principles of justice, you have the inherent right of self-defense, even if you must kill your captors.
Howard Jones says the Supreme Court decision also gave the abolitionists a new sense of power.
And the abolitionists immediately printed pamphlets, leaflets, had talks, everything they could to show that these people went free. And their implication was, this is what's going to happen to slavery itself, that this is a great victory for the black man.
But the Amistad case did not really change the situation in the United States for most black people. Many were the children of slaves and could not argue that they had been kidnapped from Africa. And it was still legal to trade slaves across U.S. state borders. The Amistad case also did not solve all the problems in the abolitionist movement. Julie Roy Jeffries says during the trials, many abolitionists worked together, including blacks and whites.
It sometimes worked very well, and it sometimes didn't work so well, but it was certainly one of the first times that blacks and whites had worked so fruitfully together.
After the Amistad victory, though, the abolitionist movement broke into different groups. Ms. Jeffrey says some black abolitionists wanted more respect from white activists. Other abolitionists just had different ideas about how best to end slavery, by trying to change the country's laws or by appealing to Americans' moral sense of right and wrong. Abolitionism did influence other movements, however. One was the missionary movement. Julie Roy Jeffrey says Christian missionaries had already been going to Africa, hoping to persuade people to follow their religion. But the Amistad case and abolitionism made more people want to share their beliefs with others. Some missionaries even converted the Amistad captives to Christianity and returned to West Africa with them. Ms. Jeffrey says the abolitionist movement also helped create the women's movement in the middle of the 1800s. She says most 19th century white women mainly cared for their families in the home, but women abolitionists played an important public role.
They weighed in on the most political question of the day. They took on activities like collecting petition signatures and raising money and giving speeches.
As a result, Ms. Jeffrey says, some women came to believe they had a right to develop their own beliefs and have political power.
Sometimes they propped up their activism by appealing to things like the Bible. One woman I remember said something like, I read my Bible and I know what it tells me. And she was opposing the minister in her church, and she was a very active abolitionist.
Yet, even if abolitionism still did not personally affect most Americans, it made an increasing number of people question whether they wanted slavery to continue. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.